Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. A grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart & Shipley, supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. Lewis, Longman & Walker, a law firm helping clients navigate the maze of regulatory and political processes. Offices in Tallahassee and statewide. More about Lewis, Longman & Walker's legislative lobbying and other governmental affairs practices is at llw-law.com. And from HR Florida State Council, representing 16,000 human resource professionals and 6,300 Florida employers. HR Florida State Council, a resource for workplace best practices for the media, lawmakers, and Florida's human resource professionals. HRFlorida.org. WFSU-FM Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
After a delay 2 weeks ago, lawmakers bring back an LGBT non-discrimination bill.
There's been a lot of discussion here today about a number of theoreticals, hypotheticals. I think that's a great conversation when there are no facts. There's a whole bunch of facts.
Also tonight, one representative says school districts overspend on construction, while the districts say that claim is simply a ploy to send more dollars to charter schools.
I mean, I understand what they're wanting to do, but, you know, don't make school districts look like we have been wasteful or reckless with tax money in order to get there.
We'll also consider a measure to keep vehicles from winding up in hidden canals and drainage ponds, and hear from an expert who says what voters like to watch on TV can help predict their preferences at the ballot box. I'm Tom Flanagan. Week 5 kicks off in the 2016 Florida lawmaking session, and this is Capitol Report. Same-sex couples can marry, but in Florida, members of the lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender communities lack a number of basic protections against discrimination. Nick Evans reports a measure that would change that is in trouble.
This was the scene 2 weeks ago in the Senate Judiciary Committee.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we're not going to do that, and we're not going to let, you know, we've had a motion and a vote on that. Let me tell you what we're going to do, folks, before anybody gets too worked up, okay?
That's Miami Republican Miguel Diaz de la Portilla trying to keep the peace when his committee first heard the LGBT non-discrimination bill. In that earlier hearing, the panel ran short of time. It was more of the same in committee Monday. The key is what's known as protected categories. That list HR reps can recite backwards and forward in their sleep. Race, color, creed, sex, pregnancy, physical disability, and national origin. Any discrimination rooted in one of those categories is prohibited when it comes to things like housing and public accommodation.
This is not a Democratic issue or a Republican issue. This is not a liberal issue or a conservative issue. This is a bill that has Republican support, Democratic support, support from across all walks of life. This is about moving civil rights forward in our time.
This is Wellington Democrat Joseph Abruzzo, and under the provisions in his bill, there would be two new protected categories: sexual orientation, and gender identity or expression. Without those additions, it's perfectly legal for an employer to fire someone for being gay. Abruzzo argues that policy discourages talented workers from coming to Florida and encourages existing residents to leave.
Florida must provide an environment that is welcome to all. The pervasive discrimination in employment that gay and transgender Floridians suffer is detrimental to the public good and results in qualified individuals unfairly denied their right to work.
But in a sort of slight return to last year's so-called bathroom bill, some lawmakers raised objections tied to the measure's impact on public accommodations, where varying levels of privacy are expected.
This bill would allow an anatomical male to undress in as a public accommodation in a gymnasium.
Supporters argue gyms don't actually fall within the state's public accommodations, but lawmakers offered other hypotheticals that likely would. Meanwhile, John Tonneson, the chief information officer for Tech Data Corporation, dismisses the line of argument completely.
There's been a lot of discussion here today about a number of theoreticals, hypotheticals. I think that's a great conversation when there are no facts. There's a whole bunch of facts.
And he backs Abruzzo's claim that including LGBT protections will be good for business.
Signaling Florida as an open and equality-focused state is an important part, we believe, in developing the talent pool, the talent attraction, and the investment in our state.
Others objected to an earlier version of Abruzzo's work that would have extended to perceived sexual orientation or gender identity. In response, Altamonte Springs Republican David Simmons drafted a broad set of revisions.
If a business is being asserted to have discriminated based upon a perception of many of these listed traits, then obviously what would happen is there would be potentially just an open door, a lot of litigation, and certainly a lot of confusion. So throughout the bill, I have removed the reference to a perception.
Despite those changes, lawmakers spent well over an hour hashing out public accommodation arguments, accomplishing little more than pushing the hands of the clock forward. After a rushed, shaky progression of amendment votes, the committee adopted Simmons's revisions. But when it came to the full bill, the vote was tied, meaning the measure failed. But after a handful of motions, the no-vote lawmakers agreed to place the matter on Tuesday's agenda for reconsideration. Even if supporters can develop winning language between now and then, the proposal is in serious trouble. Three further committee stops remain, and there's only a month of session left. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Nick Evans.
The House Appropriations Committee meets tomorrow to take up a measure limiting school construction spending and steering more dollars to charter schools. The bill comes after Miami Republican Representative Eric Frezen accused school districts of misspending on construction for new schools. But as Lynn Hatter reports, district superintendents are firing back.
For the past several years, some members of the Florida legislature have pushed to force school districts to share school construction dollars with charter schools. The Republican-led legislature has also given charters more PICO funding than traditional public schools under Governor Rick Scott's administration. Now, former Florida Secretary of State and present Pasco County Superintendent Kurt Browning believes a new proposal by the House Appropriations Committee on school construction is an attempt to justify the diversion of local public building funds to charters.
By trying to tell the public that local school districts have been wasteful with the money you have. So it's really not going to hurt school districts if we take part of this 1.5 mills. The furthest thing cannot be from the truth.
Browning is angry about a report released by Miami Republican Representative Eric Frezen. Frezen claims school districts have spent $1.3 billion more dollars on construction within the past decade than state law allows. According to the report, school construction is limited to about $22,000 per student in elementary school, $23,000 per student for middle school, and $30,000 per student in high school.
Mind you, this isn't a problem of one district or two, and if you want to ask, we can go through each one of the districts. This is a statewide problem and a statewide condition. So I wanted to bring that out so that you can have a little bit of perspective when you're having the conversation of how we should expend capital dollars, to what extent we should perhaps rein in or at least create a little bit more of a structure.
Most school construction is funded at the local level. However, the state has also kicked in a substantial amount of money. And Frezen says lawmakers need to be critical when districts claim they can't fund building or maintenance projects.
I think you will realize very quickly when you start fielding conversations about increasing the local millage from 1.5 to 2, when a school district says that it's lost its elasticity on its bonding capacity or whatever it may be, take a look at this historical trend at kind of the cost overruns that they've had on their current facilities and whether or not we have to consider putting in reins on this.
The Florida Association of District School Superintendents has issued a rebuttal to Frezen's claims. His report calls out several districts, including Pasco County. But Pasco's Browning says in his district's case, Frezen's report is misleading and inaccurate. Browning points to the inclusion of an auto mechanic facility that was added to Pasco's Career Academy as an example. That facility is high tech and it includes 2 auto bays, equipment, and a learning classroom that seats 25 students.
If you want to calculate a per student station on that, you're going to take the total project cost and you're going to divide it by 25. That's never the way that it was intended to be done, because obviously at that point you're going to be well over the $25,181 per student.
Browning says that project should not have counted because additions are exempt from the spending caps under state law. Tuesday, the House Appropriations Committee will take up a bill restricting state building funds from districts that exceed the spending caps. But it also goes a step further and tells districts that have passed additional voter-approved referendums to share those local dollars with charter schools. Here's Browning.
You have a proposal in Tallahassee that's going to micromanage school districts on how we build our schools, I think it's kind of crossing the line. I mean, I understand what they're wanting to do, but you know, don't make school districts look like we have been wasteful or reckless with tax money in order to get there.
Pasco, Walton, Calhoun, Sumter, Volusia, Hillsborough, and Washington County have all written letters questioning Fresen's analysis. And the Florida Association of District School Superintendents says more are on the way. Several superintendents say they plan to attend Tuesday's hearing. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Lynn Hatter.
Still to come on Capitol Report, the House and Senate are preparing to unveil their plans tomorrow for approving the proposed gambling agreement between the state and the Seminole tribe.
I think there needs to be some changes to it to get it through the process. I mean, obviously, not just the compact itself, but the other components with regard to paramutuals and decoupling.
To help save lives, state lawmakers are looking into putting guardrails up near water bodies on high-speed roadways.
I live in Maryland, and these tragedies are simply unheard of. Searching for why this happened, I discovered that these accidents are not only common in Florida, but Florida actually leads the nation with victims who drown in submerged vehicles.
And can your choice of TV shows predict your political choices?
Support for Capitol Report is provided by The Able Trust, 25 years of connecting businesses with workers with disabilities. Businesses are encouraged to interview and hire talented and loyal Floridians with disabilities as they seek to broaden their customer base and reach all of Florida's diverse population. Abletrust.org.
Florida lawmakers are expected to unveil their plans tomorrow for dealing with gambling in Florida. Regan McCarthy reports Governor Rick Scott has hammered out an agreement with the Seminole Indian tribe, but legislative leaders say the plan will likely need to change to garner approval.
Gaming has historically been an unpopular subject for Senate President Andy Gardner. He told journalists early in the year he's not likely to support an expansion.
I don't support the expansion of gaming, but I do support the institution of the Senate to make that decision as to what direction they want to go.
The proposed Seminole Compact is, by many accounts, an expansion. While it would bring billions of dollars of revenue into state coffers, it would also let the tribe add new gaming to its offerings, allowing the continuation of blackjack and approving new games like craps and roulette. But Governor Rick Scott reminds leaders money isn't all that's linked to those games.
This compact that I know the Seminoles and my office worked hard to make sure happened will have a positive impact on job growth. My understanding, if it's not renewed, then it would impact about, 3,500 jobs? 3,600 jobs. And if it is approved by the legislature, would add about 4,500 direct and indirect, 4,800, I guess, direct and indirect permanent jobs, and another 14,500 direct and indirect construction jobs.
Scott heard from Seminole Gaming employees last week who say they're likely to face serious hardship if the legislature does not approve the proposed compact. Olivia Davis is the administrative assistant for the Table Games Department for the Hard Rock Division.
I'm a single mother of three, and because of the tribe and the promotions that I have made, because one thing about the Seminole tribe, they promote within, and I started off at the bottom, and now I'm in the Table Games Department for 5 years, and if the compact isn't signed, then it does affect me tremendously because I will be out of a job.
The state's agreement with the tribe that allows Seminole casinos to conduct table games like blackjack has expired. If the new agreement isn't approved, some say that could mean the tribe will have to close its tables. But in the House, Speaker Steve Crisafulli says if the compact is going to get approval this legislative session, changes will likely be needed.
I think there needs to be some changes to it to get it through the process. I mean, obviously, not just the compact itself, but the other components with regard to paramutuals and decoupling and those things are, you know, those are big issues that are important to the members of this chamber. And, you know, everybody has a region or a district to represent, and you know, they're getting pressured from back at home on that as well.
And Senate President Andy Gardner echoed that sentiment during a discussion with a group of reporters, saying it's not typically what's in the compact that raises concerns, but the other activities that tend to come along with the compact, like agreements that pave the way for some paramutuals to operate slot machines. Meanwhile, Krissa Foley told reporters during a later discussion that while gambling overhaul proposals have died in the past, the timing this session could be on the Seminoles' side.
Every year there's a little bit of a different issue that comes about with it. Timing is important right now with the compact. It's obviously important from a timing perspective for the tribe. And, you know, we're conscious of that.
But Krissa Foley says a difficult roadblock remains. That's finding legislation that can get support from members in the House as well as the Senate. Both chambers are expected to discuss the details of their gaming plans Tuesday. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Regan McCarthy.
A bill aimed at cutting down the number of drowning deaths associated with car accidents in Florida has passed its first House committee. As Sasha Cordner reports, Chloe's Law stems from the death of a University of Central Florida student last year.
Clarissa Lindsay says since the age of two, she'd known her best friend Chloe Arenas.
My best friend who has the biggest passion for helping others and animals. My best friend who works a full-time job at 21 while simultaneously attending UCF and ITA. My best friend who showed me what it meant to be dedicated and hardworking.
Lindsay is now advocating on behalf of Chloe's Law, named after her best friend who died last year in Orlando. Her goal is making sure guardrails are installed on roadways near potentially dangerous water bodies.
My best friend died in a completely preventable accident. In the early hours of June 28th, my best friend Chloe Nicole Arenas was on her way to pick up her mother and grandmother to take them to the airport. Chloe fell asleep behind the wheel while traveling on State Road 408. Her car drifted into an exit-only lane, which led into an unprotected retention pond. As a result of this, Chloe unconsciously drowned in her submerged vehicle. I live in Maryland, and these tragedies are simply unheard of. Searching for why this happened, I discovered that these accidents are not only common in Florida, but Florida actually leads the nation with victims who drown in submerged vehicles.
Lindsay says this issue is important everywhere, but holds a special urgency in Florida.
These accidents mostly happen to tourists who are unfamiliar with Florida roads. I know that asking for guardrails and protective barriers along every single body of water is not realistic. Senator Soto is working with engineers to work out stipulations and measure how dangerous certain bodies of water are and figure out exactly where guardrail placement is needed. The main opposition to this legislation is cost. This is simply incomparable to human life, but does play a legitimate role. To put it in perspective, it would cost anywhere between $1,200 and $2,000 to put a guardrail along Chloe's crash site. Is $2,000 too much to ask to save my best friend's life?
She'd originally came to Kissimmee Democratic Senator Darren Soto with the idea for the legislation.
So I commit to you to do everything we can to get a solution that we could afford and one that will save lives, because reading and hearing over and over people dying in these retention ponds and in other water bodies in what are otherwise high-speed roads is something I want to see less of and ultimately
And Orlando Republican Representative Renee Plasencia later signed on as the House sponsor of the bill, which went through a change recently during its first committee hearing.
What this bill does is it asks for the DOT to go back 10 years and anywhere where there's been a death along a state road and in a drowning, a retention pond. And because of this amendment, now what happens is the DOT decides if there needs to be a barrier constructed in order to prevent such deaths. They're also going to do a survey as to the causes of death and see report back to the Speaker and to the Senate President to see if there needs to be additional barriers made along other roadways.
According to the bill's analysis, the original measure requiring the guardrails near water bodies could cost the Florida Department of Transportation $2.4 million. But it states Plasencia's latest change to the measure to leave it to the DOT's chief engineer discretion could lessen that impact. Still, some lawmakers were a bit worried about the fiscal impact. But Democratic Representative Bobby Powell says regardless, the measure is needed.
I live in Palm Beach County, where we've got an area, a stretch of Belglade, State Road 80, where many people have run off the road and have ended up in canals and died. A young man who ran track with me in high school was one of those people and ended up in a canal. The question I always think about, we look at the fiscal of this, but what is the true cost of a life? What is the true cost of a life? Life you can't get back, minutes and seconds of time. You don't get these back. Money, you can make that over and over again.
And while she says she agrees with Powell and believes the bill is important, Naples Republican Representative Kathleen Pasadomo says she still has some reservations.
What I would have preferred to see is give more discretion to
the department to determine where the barriers are to be placed, because I'm concerned that it could become an emotional issue where there's a lot of pressure placed upon the engineer based upon the bill as drafted, that they're going to put it everywhere because how are you going to decide? I think you got a little bit of work to do on the bill.
Placencia says he'll work with her to iron out those concerns. And the measure passed the House Transportation and Port Subcommittee unanimously. Meanwhile, its Senate companion has one more committee stop before heading to the floor. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Cordner.
Advocates for a young South Florida man are hoping a key state Senate committee will do again tomorrow what it did last year. Tomorrow afternoon, the Senate Judiciary Committee will once again consider a claims bill for the young man known simply as CMH. Here's his lawyer, Howard Tallenfeld of Fort Lauderdale.
CMH is a young man who was sexually and emotionally abused in a very serious way when his parents took in a foster child who was sexually reactive and sexually aggressive. And unfortunately, he spent several years of his life with his foster child in his home because his parents were Good Samaritans and volunteers.
Tallenfeld says the case went before a Palm Beach County jury.
He was awarded a judgment in the amount of little in excess of $5 million, which has only been partially paid at this point in time by the state of Florida, an amount which would barely cover the costs of litigating this case.
The to-date payout, in fact, is around $100,000. So a claims bill is pending before the legislature for the balance. Tallenfeld says the Senate committee it goes before tomorrow already passed it once.
It was a 10-0 unanimous vote last year. We truly believe that the Senate, its staff, or folks are understanding that there's a wrong that needs to be righted and that he needs this help.
But now Tallenfeld says CMH is 22 years old and in deteriorating condition.
He is seriously, seriously in a state of paralysis emotionally, and this claims bill is an opportunity to right a grave injustice in his life.
But that's just in the Senate. In the House, Tallenfeld says no claims bills tapping general revenue have been heard this session. And for his client, time could be running out. You're listening to Capitol Report from Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally tonight, the very first election in this presidential contest takes place tomorrow in New Hampshire. Of course, all the political pundits are speculating wildly on how the electorate will cast ballots in the contest. Well, if you knew a person watched a TV program like Duck Dynasty or The Daily Show, you might be able to guess their economic status or what kind of vehicle they drive. Now researchers at the University of South Florida's Muma College of Business have added voter preference to that list. And as we hear from Mark Schreiner at member station WUSF in Tampa, they've got the scientific data to back it up.
Information Systems and Decision Sciences professor Balaji Padmanabhan and doctoral student Iraj Barfar broke down nearly a half billion minutes of programs, which were watched by several hundred Nielsen panelists, to get their results. We're joined on University Beat by Professor Padmanabhan. Professor, let's get right into what your research examined.
So we looked at data from the 2012 presidential elections, and we looked at the previous 5 weeks, and we had essentially all the television shows watched by members of Nielsen's TV panel throughout the U.S., and we were constructing variables such as minutes per viewer as well as a percentage of fans to find out which TV shows might predict the outcomes. And so we ended up looking at 547 TV shows and built models for each of them to predict the outcomes at the state level and county level. And in that process, we were able to identify quite a few shows that seemed to have predictive power.
And it ended up being that three TV programs had predictive accuracies greater than 79%.
The top three programs that we found out at the state level were The Daily Show with Jon Stewart, Duck Dynasty, and Family Renovations.
Okay, I'm going to assume here that Duck Dynasty viewers and states leaned more Republican. Okay, you're shaking your head yes.
That's exactly what came out, and it was entirely from the data. The Daily Show was equally interesting. You know, more minutes per voter, more percentage of fans went Democratic.
And then family renovations, I would assume,
that
as
was
well?
Mixed. That was mixed, okay. And it was more interesting. It was a mix of the two.
How can this data then be applied?
If it works in real time, what potentially this could do is, in a week or 2 weeks prior to the elections, if you were able to predict in certain states or counties that certain party is less likely to win, it gives them real-time information on what states and counties to invest in first, right? And then second, they might look at the programs that seem to correlate more with their viewership and seek to very strategically advertise in those programs.
Now, another cool thing you did is you wanted to determine the predictive power of these viewing patterns.
If you look at how these data analytics models are built, you need to know the outcome to train a model. And so if you look at the elections, you'd say, well, you know, this means that I can figure out which shows are important after I know the elections are done. Now, what we did in this paper was we said, you know, what could we do before the elections? What if we pretended that we knew the outcomes in the safe states? And then you use that to predict the outcomes in the swing states. So in 2012, the night before the election, if we did this with the Daily Show with Jon Stewart, we would have been able to call 8 out of 10 swing states perfectly. And the ninth one, Wisconsin, was extremely close in the models as well. And the really cool part is this is based on just one TV show viewership. Potentially, we can extend these models by trying to look at combinations of shows.
Are you guys going to be using this in any sort of manner to make any sort of predictions this year or observations?
We want to, and we are actually going to get real-time data now from Nielsen on this season. And we'll keep building these models right through the primaries leading up to the elections. I'm not sure whether we'll have the guts to go and call the night before, but it'll be fun trying to play around with this in real time.
So I can't call you the night before and you're not going to tell me who's going to win.
You can call. I'm not sure they'll pick up the phone.
Information Systems and Decision Sciences Professor Balaji Padmanabhan from the USF Mouma College of Business, thank you again for joining us. I'm Mark Schreiner in Tampa.
Our regular Capital Report correspondents are Jim Ash, Sasha Kordner, Ronald J. Eben, Nick Evans, Lynn Hatter, Regan McCarthy, and Kate Payne. We also thank our contributing Florida Public Radio stations. Technical assistance for Capital Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at FPR Cap Report, and join us again each weeknight during the 2016 Florida lawmaking session for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capital Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. You can also hear Capital Report online, including archives of past shows at fprn.org. Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. A grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart & Shipley, supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. Lewis, Longman & Walker, a law firm helping clients navigate the maze of regulatory and political processes. Offices in Tallahassee and statewide. More about Lewis, Longman & Walker's legislative lobbying and other governmental affairs practices is at llw-law.com. And from HR Florida State Council, representing 16,000 human resource professionals and 6,300 Florida employers. HR Florida State Council, a resource for workplace best practices for the media, lawmakers, and Florida's human resource professionals. HRFlorida.org. WFSU-FM Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.